Hi, y'all. This episode references the 1981 slaying of 18-year-old Carmen Crone. While knowledge of Carmen's case certainly is not required to fully understand this episode, I would personally argue that it's an important supplement for it. If you feel so inclined, you can go back and listen to parts 1 and 2 of Carmen Crone's story on our feed. The episodes released on August 30th and September 7th, 2020, respectively. Also, in our show notes, you'll find links to a couple ways you can help folks searching for answers. First, a GoFundMe link to help the family of 1996 Brown County murder victim Leon Lorales, whose case desperately needs the attention of an outside investigator. Next, you'll find a couple links to DNASolves.com, where you can help law enforcement with cases that need funding, or at the very least, help generate support by sharing them on your social media accounts. The same thing can be done for Leon Lorales' GoFundMe. Any way you can help is greatly appreciated and means the world to us and to the folks involved. That's all I've got. Now on to the episode.
The Gone Cold podcast may contain violent or graphic subject matter. Listener discretion is advised.
On Saturday, December 4th, 1982, a man described as heavily suntanned and about 40 years old waited to confess his sins at Sacred Heart Catholic Church in Boise, Idaho. Before his turn came around, however, the man, who is still unidentified to this day, pulled a cyanide capsule from his pocket and swallowed it. He was dead minutes later. A couple weeks before this man took his life, about 935 miles to the southeast, 26-year-old James Harry Reyes was taken into custody after calling police in Albuquerque, New Mexico, and confessing to the murder of Catholic priest Father Patrick Ryan at the Sand and Sage Motel in Odessa, Texas, almost a year earlier, on December 21, 1981. Reyes, who was extremely intoxicated when he called and confessed, had a history of hallucinations and alcoholism. And by the time a public defender met with him in his cell, he was still drunk, but had come to his senses enough to deny killing 49-year-old Father Ryan. Reyes had been questioned about the priest's murder in the early stages of the Odessa police's investigation, since the two were lovers as far as the cops were concerned, and detectives began building their case against the Jicarilla Apache man. According to Reyes, the truth is that Father Ryan forced him to perform oral sex after getting him drunk. Because of his cultural upbringing, religious beliefs, and the general attitude towards gays and lesbians at the time, James Reyes suppressed his sexuality, and his shame and guilt was exacerbated by the sexual assault against him by Father Ryan. Police were so eager to build their case that evidence of Reyes's innocence, time-stamped receipts for goods and services in New Mexico surrounding the time of the brutal beating murder, was ignored. He also could not have possibly driven to Hobbs, New Mexico to ditch the priest's car, return to Odessa for his own pickup truck, and then driven 215 miles back to New Mexico in time to be given a speeding ticket there a few hours later. Reyes, too, had passed a polygraph test just after Father Ryan was slain. Father Ryan was thought to have come to the United States from Ireland as the result of a clergy reprimand sent to the Servants of the Paraclete in Jemez Springs, New Mexico, for, well, something he did wrong. This ministry in Jemez Springs is a place priests were sent for treatment of everything from alcoholism to sexual misconduct to pedophilia. It's known that Father Ryan propositioned two young men on at least one occasion in Hobbs, New Mexico. At trial, in defense of Reyes, those young men testified that the priest pulled up to them in his car and told them he was, quote, looking for a young stud to fuck him. End quote. The point is, and particularly considering the country's cultural climate at the time, Reyes' defense attempted to show that there were potentially others seeking to harm Father Ryan for his unsolicited sexual advances. And it's safe to say there almost certainly were. Despite all that, and the complete lack of physical evidence tying him to the scene, an Ector County jury convicted James Harry Reyes based on an alcohol-fueled confession, and likely the fact that he was gay, a Native American, and had a terrible drinking problem. The unidentified man who swallowed a cyanide capsule in an Idaho Catholic church a year after Father Patrick Ryan's murder was only theorized to be connected in 1993, just before Reyes was paroled and a Boise police detective caught wind of his claims of innocence. The unidentified man was also theorized to be involved in the November 10, 1982 strangulation death of Father Benjamin Carrier at a Yuma, Arizona motel, the known facts of which are incredibly similar to Father Ryan's murder. And one of the composite sketches closely resembles the self-poisoned man. There's far more to this story than what we've got time for here, but there is a point in going over it. A few months before Father Ryan's murder, 18-year-old Carmen Crone was violently murdered, her body found outside Odessa in an Ector County oil field. Detectives centered the entirety of their investigative attention toward a drifter named Marie Galloway for Carmen's murder. Though the cops thought another crime he had committed made him a good suspect for Carmen's slaying, evidence against Galloway was purely circumstantial and incredibly weak. Galloway never confessed and was in fact given an alibi by another man. Carmen's murder is still unsolved today, and some believe that because of his mental health issues, Murray Galloway was an easy target, a suspect the jury would surely dislike. Reminiscent in ways to James Harry Reyes' railroading by Odessa police and the county DA for the murder of Father Patrick Ryan, despite evidence clearly pointing the other way. And there's yet another case that is reminiscent of Carmen Crone's in many ways, including the failure to convict their suspect for lack of any evidence at all. Perhaps the Ector County Sheriff's Office had the right guy when they were investigating a heinous crime there in 1984, and some detectives to this day believe they did. But ultimately, there was no evidence against their suspect. None. If virtually all investigative effort had not been honed in on this man, the murder of expectant mother, Janet Gregston, might not have gone cold. We know little about Janet Gregston, unfortunately. She was born Janet Eva Roberson at Fort Hood just outside Killeen, Texas, to parents Minnie and Curtis Roberson on December 20, 1955. She graduated from Kermit High School in 1974. On May 15, 1984, Janet married Danny Gregston, who worked for the oil-filled rental company McGuire Industries. It was her second marriage. Her first, in 1979, lasted less than 2 years. Janet worked as a bartender at the club Graham Central Station on Odessa's East 8th Street. As opposed to the country western played at a majority of area bars and clubs, Graham's catered to the younger crowd. The music showcased there was more of the top 40 pop variety. Though it should be noted, country music certainly snuck into the top 40 plenty. The club was just over 2 miles from Janet and Danny's home at the Regency Square Apartments on North Tanglewood Lane. On Wednesday, August 8, 1984, the couple began running an ad in the classified section of the Odessa American newspaper to sell their 1980 gold Buick Riviera Limited. They were likely expecting an easy sale, since the two-door car had only 34,000 miles and was loaded with all the bells and whistles. Well into pregnancy at 7 months, Janet was riding along with potential buyers when Danny was away at work. On Tuesday, August 21st, 1984, at about 4:15 p.m., just outside of town, on East Loop 338, approximately 2 miles from Highway 385, in what was then a relatively desolate, lightly traveled area, Ector County Sheriff's Deputy David Montgomery found the body of a woman roadside. Because he had been dispatched to the scene of a hit-and-run accident involving a pedestrian and a car, Deputy Montgomery naturally assumed that the woman was the victim of such. But when he approached, it became clear fast that he wasn't looking at the body of someone who had died from injuries sustained being struck by an automobile. Rather, she was the victim of a stabbing. The body was identified shortly thereafter as that of 28-year-old expectant mother, Janet Eva Gregston. At autopsy, it was discovered Janet had been stabbed 20 times and her throat slashed. As Ector County Sheriff's Office deputies began investigating the murder of Janet Gregston, they discovered she and her husband had been attempting to sell their car. Since the vehicle was not at home and was found nowhere near the victim, looking for it became one of the first orders of business. Authorities subsequently found the Gregston's gold 1980 Buick Riviera Limited at an unspecified time and date. Those and other details pertaining to the beginning of the investigation are scarce, as Janet's slaying wasn't reported in local media for nearly a month, perhaps as a courtesy to the mother of Janet's husband, who worked at the Odessa American newspaper as an office manager. The location where the Buick was found is slightly less mysterious. It was parked on a residential street called Inglewood Lane, just blocks from Janet and Danny's apartment on Tanglewood. The cops later commented that they believed the Buick had been hand-cleaned by her killer at an area car wash, both inside and out. Because the car was involved, deputies theorized first that Janet's killer called to set up a test drive as a ruse. Perhaps the assailant intended to rape the expectant mother, but she fought too hard, and he became angry upon losing control of her. Certainly, it wasn't to steal the car, since it was found quickly and not too far from the Gregston home. Detectives with Ector County also thought that Janet might have been abducted straight from her apartment at about 3:15 p.m., though it was never made clear if they had any evidence of this. Janet certainly had no known enemies, no one she had cheated or wronged in any way. Whatever the case, it seems that the heinous handiwork of the person who killed Janet Gregston was thwarted in the act by an eyewitness. Ector County detectives rushed to find the man who had led them to Janet's body, the man who had reported it as a hit and run. James Puga was not difficult to find. He told the police that he was traveling East Loop 338 that day when he saw a man and a woman arguing. The mannerisms and gestures of the man appeared violent, Puga told detectives, and what happened next has been reported as two drastically different stories. In one report, he simply drove past the fighting couple without stopping, and in another, it's reported Puga stopped and asked if he could help. The man threatened to kill him, and he drove away. Whichever is true, Puga then told police he saw the woman fall, and the man drove off in a gold Buick. Puga began following the assailant, but after traveling south on 42nd Street a couple miles, near University Boulevard, Puga lost him in traffic. The man was traveling south on Parkway Boulevard in Janet Gregston's car the last time he was seen. Michael Puga then called police to report what he had seen. Though the stretch of road wasn't well traveled, the fact that she'd been slashed and stabbed repeatedly in broad daylight made Janet's slaying an unusual one. Funeral services for Janet Eva Gregston were held at 10 a.m. on Friday, August 23, 1984, at Sherwood Baptist Church. Reverend Leonard Hartley oversaw and officiated the service, and Janet was buried at Sunset Memorial Gardens. Almost a month after the murder of Janet Gregston, the first story about it finally ran in the Odessa American. On September 15, 1984, buried way back on page 2B, a description of the killer is featured at the end of a short article. But the primary goal of this piece was to reach another man, someone who did not match the description of the suspect, according to Janet's husband, a potential witness known only as Doug. In the classified section of the Odessa American, Danny Gregston placed an ad that also ran on September 15th. It asked for a man to come forward named Doug, who test drove he and Janet's 1980 Buick Riviera on the Sunday before she was slain, or August 19th. In the article the Ector County Sheriff's Office arranged to run in the newspaper on the same day, Detective Monty Weddle insisted that Doug was not a suspect. Rather, the department was looking to determine if fingerprints lifted from the Buick were that of the killer. It was a simple process of elimination, Detective Weddle commented. There had only been a few individuals who test drove the vehicle, so if the cops could find Doug, the remaining prints were surely the killer's. None of the prints were Danny Gregston's, incredibly. Doug, the article went on, showed up to test drive the Gregston's car in a brown or maroon four-door sedan, a dark-headed man driving. Again, this man Doug was said by Danny Gregston to not match the description of the suspect James Puga saw assaulting Janet on the side of East Loop 338, but the two descriptions are, in fact, markedly similar. Doug was described as a white male in his 30s with brown hair and a brown mustache. He was 5 feet 9 to 5 feet 10 inches tall. He weighed approximately 160 to 165 pounds and wore a gold chain around his neck. The suspect seen fighting with Janet just before her body was discovered was a white male. The description in the same article read, he was about 5 feet 10 inches to 6 feet tall and weighed 170 to 175 pounds. The suspect was approximately 33 to 35 years old, with light-colored eyes, and he had a full mustache, brown in color. He wore a white baseball cap pulled over his collar-length reddish-brown hair with short sideburns. The description continued, and his brown cowboy boots were scuffed up. The suspect's shirt was white and blue plaid Western style, and he wore brown Western cut pants. Even considering the similarities in the descriptions of the two men, Detective Weddle again maintained that the man known only as Doug was not a suspect. It's unclear if he ever came forward, or if he was ever found. Oddly, a man who did not match the description of the suspect at all would eventually be the sole focus of the investigation into the murder of Janet Eva Gregston. 10 days later, on September 25, 1984, more than a month after Janet was savagely murdered, a composite sketch of the suspect was released in an ad sponsored by Odessa Crime Stoppers. Along with the perpetrator's description and likeness, Crime Stoppers offered a $1,000 reward for information leading to an arrest and indictment. Ector County Sheriff Bob Brookshire, too, announced that friends of his had offered up an extra $5,000 for the same, and a conviction on top of it. A couple weeks after the release of the suspect's description and reward announcements, a man named Henry Hill came into the picture. On Wednesday, October 3, 1984, 33-year-old oil-filled roughneck Henry Lee Hill strolled into the Ector County Sheriff's Office with some extraordinary claims. The day Janet Gregston was slain, Hill told detectives, he was having visions she was going to be harmed, a result of what Hill called his extrasensory perception powers. Hill went to the area near her apartment that day, believing she was in grave danger, he continued in a voluntary statement, and saw her getting into her 1980 gold Buick Riviera with a man. This was a man Hill told detectives he had warned Janet about. Ector County authorities naturally added Henry Lee Hill to the suspect pool immediately, and later went on to say that the man's statement revealed information and circumstances that he could not have possibly known unless he had direct knowledge of Janet Gregston's murder. Right away, detectives began investigating Hill, and they found it suspicious that he'd changed employers 3 times since August 21st, the day Janet was killed. Later that month, Ector County deputies brought in eyewitness James Puga to undergo hypnosis in a videotaped session. Though they say Puga positively identified Henry Lee Hill as the man he saw fighting with Janet shortly before her body was discovered, Captain Gene Kloss called the session a bust, more or less, adding that the department had a composite sketch that he wasn't so sure about, therefore he was not ready to release it. Since a composite sketch of the suspect was released in Crime Stoppers newspaper spots nearly a month prior to Captain Kloss's comment, the sketch he spoke of was an entirely different one, presumably, possibly made during the hypnosis of eyewitness James Puga. In late November 1984, Justice of the Peace R.G. Hungerford signed off on an arrest warrant for Henry Lee Hill. The charge: capital murder. The aggravated circumstance was Janet's kidnapping. On the 27th, Hill was arrested at his home.
"He just came in out of the clear blue sky,"
Ector County Sheriff's Office Captain Gene Kloss told reporters, adding,
"He claimed he had ESP powers. We didn't throw him out. We listened, and he became a suspect."
Judge Manuel Vaez set Hill's bond at $250,000. What followed was a set of events that unfolded in a troublingly similar way to another case a few years before, when the prosecutor attempted to try Murray Galloway for the murder of Carmen Crone. Same players and all. On Thursday, January 10, 1985, a grand jury indicted 33-year-old Henry Lee Hill for the murder of 28-year-old Janet Eva Gregston. Judge Gene Ader of Texas's 70th Judicial District, however, ordered that before a trial date could be set, Hill must undergo psychiatric evaluation to determine if he was fit to stand trial. The prisoner was subsequently transferred from the Ector County Jail to one in Travis County, where Hill would be examined by state psychiatrist Dr. Richard Coons. A written report was to be submitted to the court no later than March 6, 1985, Judge Ader ordered. These orders were only the first in a series of setbacks for Ector County authorities. When the results of Henry Lee Hill's psychiatric examination came back, a hearing was quickly set for mid-April. After listening to the county's top mental health authority, Dr. Robert Roundtree, as well as 2 written statements from state authorities in Austin, an Ector County jury decided within an hour that Hill had to undergo treatment before he could stand trial for capital murder and face a death sentence. The prisoner was sent to Rusk State Hospital for treatment, where he was given medication and housed in the facility's maximum security unit. The first reports written on Henry Lee Hill at Rusk diagnosed him as psychotic, a troubled man who suffered from hallucinations and delusions, unable to differentiate between what is real and what is not. Still, even considering this diagnosis and his medicated state, Hill was in his right mind enough to deny that he had anything to do with killing Janet Gregston. Hill told doctors at Rusk State Hospital, however, that he did know Janet because she bartended at a place he frequented, Graham Central Station. Ector County Sheriff's Office Captain Gene Kloss acknowledged that Hill probably did know the murdered expectant mother, but whether their relationship was anything more than barfly and bartender is not known. Graham's Central Station was also known around town as something else, the last place 18-year-old Carmen Crone was seen before her body was found mutilated and posed on an Ector County Conoco oil field in 1981. Some detectives believed that Carmen's murderer and Janet's killer were one and the same. Henry Lee Hill was confined to Rusk from April of 1985 to February of 1986. In fact, he was declared competent to stand trial on January 31, 1986, and released to Ector County authorities the following day. A trial was scheduled to begin on Tuesday, April 22, 1986. But as competent as they were, trying the case wouldn't prove easy for authorities. At a pretrial hearing on Wednesday, March 26, 1986, even the prosecutor admitted that Henry Hill had been released too early. Hill's court-appointed defense, the seemingly unstoppable Jim Bobo, was so confident in his client's inability to stand trial, in fact, that he waived the right for a jury to make that call. Ector County's top authority on everything mental health, Dr. Robert Roundtree, told Judge Gene Ader that if a trial were to happen now, Henry Hill would have no understanding of what was going on. He was in a highly schizophrenic state, Dr. Roundtree said. Hill's trial was postponed pending a decision from Judge Ader. A final decision finally came on Wednesday, July 2, 1986, when the judge dismissed the capital murder charge against Henry Lee Hill and released him from custody. But it wasn't only Hill's mental condition and his need for treatment that led to the dismissal. At the July 2 pretrial hearing of the State of Texas versus Henry Lee Hill, it became known to the court that part of the videotaped hypnosis of James Puga, the eyewitness who identified Hill as Janet Gregston's killer in that very hypnosis session, had been partially, or mostly, recorded over by mistake. Since Texas state law required that juries be allowed to see or hear the entirety of video and audio recordings of hypnosis sessions so they could fairly ascertain whether the interviewer had posited suggestions or led the interviewee toward a desired outcome, the testimony of eyewitness James Puga, both the hypnosis tape and a post-hypnosis testimony, was now inadmissible. Simply put, with the hypnosis tape gone, the jury could have no idea if the testimony of Puga was placed in his head during that session. But that was not the only hitch. The previous February, a bulletin had been passed around the Ector County Sheriff's Office implying that the department had charged the wrong man for the murder of Janet Gregston. The bulletin was written and distributed by Lieutenant Jerry Davis, who was attempting to gather more information on the case, specifically on the perpetrator, as he investigated. According to Sheriff Bob Brookshire, the bulletin's purpose was not to imply that they'd nabbed an innocent man, Rather, it was a simple and standard procedure to attempt to identify additional suspects. Defense attorney Jim Bobo, however, knew damn well how to make the bulletin work in his favor when he told the court it didn't make sense for detectives to be out looking for another man if they were confident they had the right one. The bulletin was released a year after Hill's arrest. The court agreed that the bulletin looked as if it implied that some detectives were having doubts about Hill's guilt. Jim Bobo knew what it took to provide reasonable doubt, real reasonable doubt, to the minds of a jury and judge. Even long before any hypnosis took place, James Puga's eyewitness statements, Bobo argued, were of no value to reality at all. Even the description of the assailant and composite sketch should be called into question, neither of which matched the description of Henry Lee Hill, who was on the lower end of average height at 5 feet 7 inches tall and noticeably thin at only 145 pounds. Anyway, Bobo had pointed out that Puga had identified three other men as suspects before identifying his client while under hypnosis. One on the very day Janet was slain, August 21st, 1984, a different man 4 days later on the 25th, and yet a third man on September 6th, 1984. Jim Bobo perhaps took it a step too far when he accused Ector County Sheriff's Office deputies of ignoring James Puga when he told them he had identified the wrong guy in Henry Lee Hill. Puga, however, signed a sworn statement that he did not, in fact, ever claim such a thing. At the end of the day, Sheriff Brookshire was forced to admit that Puga had identified a different assailant more than once, further bringing into question the reliability of the testimony the eyewitness might have given were he allowed. That evening, Henry Lee Hill walked out of the Ector County Jailhouse. The following day, he left Odessa for good. His defense attorney, Jim Bobo, declined to say where the man was heading and only commented that Hill won't be making his home in Odessa, Texas. Hill was on medication and planned to continue to seek help for his condition. When confronted with questions implying his client walked free due to technicalities, Bobo's annoyance was palpable. He told reporters the case against his client was about as weak as it possibly could have been, and that was before the accidental erasure of the hypnosis tape brought the prosecutor's house of cards down. Hill had never told detectives anything about Janet's murder that only someone involved would know, Jim Bobo said. Every bit of knowledge he had came from newspaper reports. They had nothing on Henry Lee Hill because the man was innocent, the defense attorney said. But Monty Weddle, who was no longer with the Ector County Sheriff's Office when the charges were dropped against Henry Hill, was still insistent that they had the right man. Weddle told reporters that there was no way Henry Lee Hill could have led investigators to the exact spot of Janet Gregston's violent death in the dark if he hadn't have been there. The former sheriff's deputy said the slaying was the work of a highly intelligent killer. It was premeditated, and the killer probably wore a disguise, Weddle said. A statement likely intended to make up for the fact that Hill's description did not match that of the suspect, as originally reported by eyewitness James Puga. Meanwhile, Danny Gregston was crushed. When the cops told him they'd got the guy who killed his wife and his child, he believed them, and it was hard to understand why that killer was walking free. Danny kept to himself for a while, struggling to come to terms with his grief, and angry no justice was doled out. Henry Lee Hill remains a suspect for the murder of Janet Gregston, as far as we can tell. But besides a promise to continue forth with the investigation just after charges were dropped on the man, Virtually nothing new has been publicized on the case in the years since. There were no renewed calls for information in the press, not even in the form of anniversary stories, until 2016, and no testing of evidence since the use of DNA in law enforcement investigations became standard practice that we know of. Since charges were dropped against him in 1986, Henry Lee Hill has collected only a few minor infractions of the law on his record. Virtually all are misdemeanors, and none are the result of violence of any kind. If you have any information about the murder of Janet Eva Gregston, please contact Odessa Crime Stoppers at 432-333-8477. The Odessa American, the Austin Chronicle, and UPI Archives were used as sources for this episode. You can support the show at patreon.com/gonecoldpodcast. There, you can get the show ad-free and enjoy Patreon-exclusive episodes that tell the stories of mostly solved Texas crimes and the bad actors who perpetrated them. I get those out as much as I can. Another way you can support Gone Cold is by leaving us a 5-star rating and written review on iTunes or wherever else you listen. Those reviews help Gone Cold's visibility, which helps new listeners find us. However you support the show, we'd like to thank you. Thanks for listening, y'all.